As I say, it was quite a sweat.
Quite a sweat. Right.
But in any case, I joined HMS. I was to join HMCS Magnificent after the course finished, and so an opportunity arose where we had permission to take the what we call the A license standard flying course out of HMS Gosport, just across the way from Pompey. And the most exciting time was had by all, because John Mason and I, he also being allowed to do so, were the two elderly gentlemen, as it were, taking the course. The instructors, amongst whom was the most astounding Australian character with a wild sense of humor, who was assigned to me, and we soldiered around the sky simplistic, austere, Tiger, open cockpits, no radios, of course, no nothing, and shouting between one another, and it was strictly scenes from Hell's Angels when we were aloft with our leather caps and goggles and scarves out at the back and all the rest of it, and a skid for at the blunt end, a skeg kind of thing rather than a wheel, and. But the great thing was 90 knots, straight up, straight ahead, straight down. And if things get really tough, take your hands off the controls, and more than likely the plane will land itself without too much damage. I remember that later on. Because, you see, after we'd done a fair amount of duel, and we had the whole business, aerobatics and all the rest of it, of course, those little planes were absolutely astounding for aerobatics. They could do anything. And moreover, very slowly, thank God, and so the G level was not horrendous, and therefore we more or less kept our meals. But the time eventually came, and I was feeling pretty good. We'd gone around, and I'd done all the right things this time, for once in my life, so to speak. And sure enough, to my horror, my Australian hopped out and said, "Right, you're on your own, mate!" And I said, "Go!" I damn you froze. Anyway, away we go. And you must understand, the runway, I can see it to this day, as clear as a bell. It's not very long, and at the end of which there's a large copse of trees. And the thing is, you must clear the trees quite clearly. And moreover, as you get over the other side, you're into the Solent, if you're not aloft. So, off we go. Flat out, you see, and you hold on to the stick, and you've got your throttle going like crazy, and you think everything's fine. Feet on the pedals, and your arse tight. And then pull back, and zip, away we go. Not too high, but not too much. Of course, if you go up too sharply, you stall. If you don't go high enough, you land in the woodwork, or your wheels do, and then that's game over. Anyhow, I got off. Round I went, and then the crosswind, downwind leg, and upwind leg, and eventually, as I came to turn onto the final, before I turned the last leg before final, there was a big steel pylon. I can remember this as clear as a bell, and I became rather fascinated with this damn thing. And so, as I turned, the nose came up, and I began to stall, and she started to side slip. And I did everything with my feet and my backside and everything else, and of course it was to no avail. And things were getting very sick. And then eventually, I don't know, somebody said, "Do it, my boy," which is to put the stick forward and pour on the coal. Yeah. And of course I gathered momentum rapidly and heading rather rapidly also to the deck, which is only less than 500 feet away, don't forget. I did have an altimeter, I'll give you that much. Anyhow, the thing was, everything turned out nice again, as it were, because she began to fly, and I came roaring down to the deck, and I had enough wit, I was so frightened, it doesn't matter, pulled everything back, and she bounced along, and of course everybody was running down the runway behind me, and and then the next thing, as I looked back, I could see my instructor, and he said, come on, that's great, you did great, that's just perfect, bring it around again. So I thought, oh my God. So anyway, I must say, the next time I came around, it wasn't quite so bad.
You took off
from there on, oh yeah, and from there on, life shaped up, and it was pretty good. But all I can say is,
it's technically called a touch and go. In your case, it was a touch, 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 and go.
Well, you know, it was an exhilarating experience, at the very least. But one, looking back on it, I suspect an enormous number of aviators go through a similar experience that I did. And no doubt my little script is a very little consequence. But from my life point of view, it was a hallmark, something I'll never forget, because it was so, I was very much completely dependent upon anything that I ever had by the way of my so-called wits. And if I didn't pull it off, I knew it was being all in. So,
well, it's an interesting comment on the training at the time. It was, it was survival of the fittest, I guess.
Well, sure. And then there was another thought, which is rather amusing. I have it till this day. It's a little certificate to do with my flying course. There's a photograph in there of Lieutenant P.G. Chance. And it's signed by Lord Brabazon of Tara. And it says, Lieutenant Chance is licensed to fly all types of land planes.
Oh, God.
This is with a certificate one got in those days. Fantastic. And of course, it doesn't mean anything nowadays, except it's a museum piece, I suspect.
Anyway, you still got that?
Sure.
We should get a photograph of it anyway.
It's a fun thing. I'm sure there must be lots of them around.
Well, not many of them lived, I wouldn't
think. I don't know, I have no idea. Anyway, that was my little caper. Then I joined Magnificent. And
now, it's about here. I have a question that mm-hmm. the historian would be interested in. Other people have commented that from 45 to 50, yeah. the efficiency of the Royal Canadian Navy and the morale in the Royal Canadian Navy sank, and that Korea pulled it back up again.
Yes.
This is what one would expect. You were getting rid of the people that had lived through the war and starting all over again.
Yeah.
So just keep that in mind if you want to comment on it. Here you are in Magnificent, close to the Korean War.
Yes, well, so, you see, I have some very live recollections of that time frame between 45 and 50. But so far as I was concerned, certainly my own notions of morale about what was going on were never higher. I had good jobs, interesting things to do, and so on. Nonetheless, I was aware of there was unrest amongst certain segments of the ship's companies, and this was, to me, was inflamed in part by what was considered to be, by some certainly, as a kind of hangover of the RN image in officers, insofar as the way they dealt with their men. And there were a number of our senior officers who were pretty seriously castigated for this kind of thing, although looking back on it, they all made flag ranks, so far as I can make out, or, you know, pretty well. But in all fairness, I have never met any of the people who were criticized for their so-called service attitudes and what amounts to their OLQs, or officer-like qualities. I think they were unjustly criticized, because I think they were, in the main, they were damn good officers. But there was a rising tide of, we're going to be Canadians, pal, or else. And so anything that was to do with our old UK traditions and linkages were getting pretty tender insofar as to the breaking point. And I think of incidences, for instance, when a number of people in Magnificent, and they were goaded by a couple of officers who were anti the rest, and both, one was a Scot and the other was an Englishman. One, the Englishman was on loan, and the Scot was an old hand who had been in our Navy for a long time, an engineer. who's a great guy. I've got all kinds of time for him, but he hated the guts of the commander. That's as easy as that. And there was a kind of thing that was developed, and so the commander was the butt of all the criticism, which in point of fact came out in that there was some forgotten who they call it. Oh, bless my soul.
The Mingy Report?
The Mingy Report, thank you.
Well, then, to go back to see, the Mingy that, Report, who was driving Maggie in those days?
Well, first of all, Admiral DeWolf. Commodore Miles took over.
So, who did you have her under?
I spent 90% of my time with Commodore Miles.
Yeah, but you saw a little bit of your old Captain DeWolf, and then...
Just for a second, and then onward with Captain Miles, yeah.
And so Miles was a captain,
yeah.
And the XO was
Debbie Pierce,
and
Ginger Balfour.
Yeah, I remember. Somebody threw Debbie Pierce's telescope over the side.
And not only that, they lowered the flaming ladder into the drink in Halifax Harbor.
Well, the accommodation ladder?
Yeah. Fantastic. And that was promoted, and with all due respect, looking back on it, and without fear, favor, or affection, it was inflaming of certain members and groups within the ship's company to do something which was going to cause embarrassment to the commander.
Yeah.
I was the senior washkeeper in that ship.
Yeah.
And I had no problems.
No.
Not because of me, but because the criticism wasn't directed to my lowly level. Oh, hell no. And I was merely a doer, and frankly, I had no problems doing.
No.
Debbie Pierce, I don't know him as, I don't call him Debbie, but my wife does, but I've always known Admiral Pierce to be utterly fair, and I've served him in the barracks and in Magnificent, and when he was in Washington, I was on Sacramento, and so on. And we've met on several occasions in several ships, of course, Magnificent being the one where he was commander. But you see, it wasn't just there that this row was starting. If you recall, Admiral, oh, bless my soul, he was the commander of Ontario for a day or two, and then he caused a mutiny himself by his behavior.
Well, that's Geoffrey Brock.
Geoffrey Brock. He was the instigator of all that trouble.
Which trouble where?
In Ontario, HMCS Ontario.
Oh, yes, I've got that on the tape.
Of course you have, and I'm sure you have. But to say that the service was going rotten, as it were, to me, was a misstatement. It's wrong. There was nothing wrong with the company at all.
Well, that's
in
fine.
In fact, we had come from, gosh, I don't know, six or seven vessels in commission, relatively speaking, certainly very, very few fighting vessels at the beginning of the war, to 400 ships in commission. We come from 1,800 people to 400,000. My goodness me, we've done an enormous job. So, I grant you, the wind-down, the attitude, that what's enough of that, the VRs going out, and bless them, they were marvelous people, and they did an enormous job. But they wouldn't have done as good a job as they did do had there not been the core of trained people who were able to bring them on.
Like Debbie Pierce.
Like Debbie Pierce, well, of course.
Now,
anyway,
part of this morale business might have been the influx of new sailors that had not seen the war. There's a new generation coming in at the bottom.
That's true, and we also went through another phase where in 1947 there was a major transfer from RCNVR officer ranks to permanent commissions. And I've forgotten what they call that, but there was a time when a large number of people transferred from an extended RCNVR active list commission, which went beyond the end of the war, and then they had an opportunity to come in with adjusted seniority and so on as permanent force officers. And this always made me smile a bit, because, you see, I had been a VR midshipman from 38. End of 38 through the spring and summer and the winter of 39, to the point that I'm supposed to become an acting sub-lieutenant, as I was supposed to be all set. And then Harry DeWolf said to me, you know, would I like to join, which is in the previous piece. So, as far as I was concerned, my seniority was not adjusted, that's for damn sure.
Well, you went back from nearly an acting sub-lieutenant through midship and to cadet.
To a civilian.
To a cadet. And came in again. Yeah.
And so, okay, so anyway, that neither here nor there looking back. But a great pal of mine, for whom I have the utmost respect, by the name of Starchy Brown, who was my next-door neighbor when we grew up, why, he eventually, he had lots more seniority, and he had his times too, but nonetheless, there was this considerable discrepancy, and that in itself might have been cause for some irritation. I just don't know.
In addition to which, a lot of officers were brought over directly from the Royal Navy to serve in the Royal Canadian Navy, and they were known locally as DKs, displaced kippers.
The DKs, and there was one in particular, a man with whom I served, nice enough guy, and a damn good staff officer. He's a, with all due respect, he's a lousy leader of Canadians. He might have been great in his own,
that's the point.
Unfortunate insofar as his leadership qualities were Canadians. And I had nothing other than respect for him, and no point in saying his name.
No.
But he and I knew one another very well, and then eventually he was promoted, and I wasn't, and I don't mind telling you, I was damn bitter, because he was brought in, he was senior to me, and he was older than I, but with no seniority in our service. And with no specialist qualification or anything of that sort. And it was that was one of the frustrations that I had.
Yeah.
And so in this respect, but that didn't come up till later, by the way.
So
that
there,
frustration. That was 56.
Yeah.
In that time frame, 56 to 60. But anyway.
So let's get back to Maggie.
So in Maggie, I was still a two-striper. Keen as mustard and having a great time, and all sorts of interesting people and whom I enjoyed in every way, or as friends and as professionals. And we were a happy company. We really were. And unfortunately, my time in that ship was shortened by virtue of a very sad thing that happened. As an operational exercise, the ship was sent into a place called Port Matoun, spelled M-O-U-T-O-N. And the navigator of the ship, who lives here nowadays, whose name is WDF Bill Johnston, one of the nicest men I've ever met, and a most capable officer if there was one.
I agree.
He had the sad situation of the ship taking the ground on an unmarked rock. And the trial that took place, oh yes, and first of all, she went on good and hard. And I was standing in the wardroom at the time, I wasn't on watch, and I ran for the bridge. And having been through one exercise of this sort in Skeena, I knew the seriousness of the situation. So, and the captain, Gus Miles, whom I got to know personally, and was very fond of and had great admiration for him and his family. He said, "Peter, would you go over the side and sound around the ship?" So I asked us, which I did. And sure enough, there was plenty of water all around us. But she had ridden up on a pinnacle of some sort. Well, we tried everything. Everybody aft. Aircraft aft. All sorts of things. And it didn't work. And indeed, I was speaking the other day with Skinny Hayes, when he was recounting a similar incident when Warrior had a steering gear failure and she rammed up onto the putty in the river from the St. Lawrence. They tried the same, and there was no way. The weight of men and materiel has nothing whatsoever to do with correcting the ship's draft situation from a fore and aft angle.
Yeah.
Worth a damn. Anyway,
So you went through that was probably on record in the court-martial proceedings. Yeah.
Oh, I guess so. There was a fellow named Chadwick who was driving one of the destroyers. I forgot who else was. And they tried to haul us off, and hawsers were parted, and all sorts of things, a terrific pressure and strain. But sure enough, she came off and with the tide and tugs and so on, and we went over to the St. John Dry Dock. And the gunnery officer of the ship, I guess, or was it the training officer? I'm not sure. Anyway, Tom Pullen and I, and a fellow named Pierre Simard, who is still in the service, I think. No, he's retired now, too. But relatively recently. A fellow by the name of... that was the best man, too. John Anderson Farquhar, Jack Farquhar, and a number of others were all taken out of Magnificent, and we took HMCS Iroquois out of the reserve fleet, mothballs, and we got her going in very short order, with the prime object of taking over the UNTD training for the summer of 1949.
All right.
Summer of 1949. Because during the winter of 48, we went to what was called Maple Royal.
Yes, I remember
we
that.
We were down in the West Indies for that effort. And I remember that very well. But there was one occasion, I'll never forget it, when a man by the name of Roy De Nevers was a pilot. And he had a young Scotsman whose name escapes me at the moment. Anyway, they did the reverse course business.
Yes.
And they went off the trail. Mm-hmm. And eventually Roy realized that he made a mistake, and he reversed and he came back. And as the last piece of light, having got him back on the radar, and having got it, we got him on deck. And I'll never forget it, because it was the most exciting endeavor, if there ever was one. Another little squib in that same ship was when Dickie Bartlett, the fellow by the name of Peter Berry, driving a Fairy Firefly Mark II, I think, I've forgotten. Anyway, they came around, and I was watching this one. Somebody else was on the scope down below, and they tipped the wire, and whatever it was, they missed, and in order to go around, he had to give it to her. Of course, in those days, if you recall, we had the barrier as opposed to the angled deck. And I remember giving her all the power in the world, did a big torque stall straight into the drink. And I'm delighted to say both of them were heaved out, which was good.
What was the standard of flying like in the Maggie in those days? We're now into nearly 49, because I joined her a little after that, and it was not
well,
good then.
We had Sea Furies and Fireflies and a lot of flying, and they were pretty good as far as I was concerned. There wasn't all that much opportunity, unfortunately, and night deck landings were something that we weren't too keen on.
Did you do some? Careful.
Yeah, we did some.
Because we never did when I
did
was
you?
In there, just was later. Was McEwen the commander error?
He was, again, one of the instigators of the drop in morale. That man, I'm afraid, was not a friend insofar as our outfit was concerned. He is an interesting man.
Well, I served with him under Commodore Adams.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
When, again, and, in Magnificent.
Again in Magnificent.
After she came out of the dry dock.
Yes. And we noticed we killed a lot of pilots, 3, 4, 5. And he was replaced by Grattan Cooper, and the standard of flying went right up.
Yep.
And the standard of discipline among the pilots went right up.
Well, you see, this sort of a... devil-may-care attitude is all very fine and large, and again, we're back to dawn patrol or something.
Yes.
But with the sophisticated machines, relatively speaking, we had that, it was just not on.
Well, that's, I wanted, so, if you agreed, I mean, that was my experience, and I just wanted to get yours down for whoever listens to this.
Yeah. Right.
So you're in Maggie, and we've covered my questions. Mm. We're getting close to the Korean War.
Now, yes, after Magnificent, I came ashore. After Iroquois, that is. Yeah. I came back ashore.
How long were you in Iroquois?
Again, it was the long summer, as it were, from... where do we go? June until the end of October. That's right. And then I went to the Nav School as the senior staff officer with, again, now let me think. I think it was Jack Pickford was the CEO, my senior officer. I'm not... Either Jack Pickford... yes, I think it was. Anyway, the next thing that happened...
I was across the parade square, by the way.
Of course you were.
As senior staff officer, yes.
That's
Gunnery
right.
School.
And we had enormous days and nights.
And nights.
Thank you. The next thing was for me that in early New Year in April, I guess it was, I had a pierhead jump. It was a 2 weeks' notice to go from Halifax to Victoria to join HMCS Cayuga as the squadron navigating officer of the CANCOM Bezron 3, I think it was called, in the language of the communicators and so on, to take the ship out to Korea for a year. And we were the sort of the second run, as it were, that the war having begun and Cayuga being the first, in the first crowd with... again, Brock is the senior officer.
Yes.
And Andy Collier was the pilot.
Yes.
And so I was going to relieve Andy Collier. And with Commodore, at that time, Commander James Plomer, subsequently known as the Galloping Ghost of the Korean Coast. Anyway, as his navigator, and known to everyone as Pontius, God knows, but he
was... Well, Pontius for... Yeah,
yeah,
for
that was me.
Pontius Pilot.
So,
excuse me, the people listening to this tape won't be as bright.
Well, I don't know about that. Anyway, with a new vehicle that I acquired at great expense, because I felt that if I didn't, we were going to be in real trouble. And don't forget, in April of 1951, by now, it was impossible to cross our country. One had to go through the United States, and even then you expected desert-like temperatures during the day and snow at night.
Yeah.
And so, however, in 7 days and a little more, we managed to get across, having gone to visit my parents, who were both living in those days, in Ottawa. And also, we managed to stop for an hour or two in London, Ontario, where my wife and I met the doctor who had been our doctor in Skeena, a man named John A. Lewis, who I think is still alive, and he's a heart specialist who always wore his life jacket to the dining room table in the wardrobe, which was a little unnerving. However,
so
he was a marvelous man. But going back, we got out to Victoria. I was greeted on a Thursday afternoon on the maiden steps by a most marvelous guy whom I've known for a long, long time, who retired as a rear admiral by the name of Charlie Dillon. And Charlie Dillon, and he always called me Pedro. And so I said, "Hi, Pedro. Hi, Peg." And we had the three children by this time. One was in a carry cot, and the other two, one had been sick most of the way across the country, and the other one had combed my wife Peggy's hair from the back, and so she was raw on her neck by this time. Very patient woman. Anyway, said, "What are you doing?" So I told him I was out to join Cayuga. He said, "Oh yeah, great." And then I said, "What on earth's going on? There's nobody here. This is Thursday. Doesn't anybody... I've heard about this golf course Navy you have out here, but surely to God, Wednesday's making men, isn't it? What about Thursday?" He said, "Well, I tell you what, we have Thursdays making men." Oh, okay, fair enough. Apparently it had something to do with shopping or some local endeavor. However, everything was very pleasant. and we moved into a place called the San Sebastian, which is now since gone, but it was a kind of a group of cottage-like buildings, a motel on the gorge, which was used for many, many years by people such as ourselves moving in and out of ships. Well, on the way out, I had developed a very rotten toe, and it was getting very bad.
Is this by car or in Cayuga? Oh, you're still
driving.
In the car.
Yeah. Yeah. So I clocked into the hospital, and they said, well, you're in trouble. I reckon you've got about at least 3 weeks here. So I said, you've got to be kidding, my friend. I've psyched up my family to the notion that once more I'm going to be away. And I'm a seaman, yes, but that's fine. But I've been away most of my married life, such as it is. And now you're sending me away for yet another year where the vast majority of the armed forces are on their backsides in Canada, enjoying life, and I'm supposed to go up and do my thing. That's fine. I'm prepared to do that. But for God's sake, let me go.
Yeah.
Don't make it tough for my family again. I said, well, I'll tell you what you do. I understand your problem. Why don't you go down to your ship? There's a new doctor just joined. His name is Dr. Joseph Sear. And he's going to be your doctor. I said, oh, yeah, that's great. Never heard of him. Said, well, he's an American, as a matter of fact, but he's in your ship. So I said, oh, yeah, that's great. So I went down to the ship, and sure enough, I met this very fascinating, rather Falstaffian kind of fellow with a broad Boston accent, who greeted me in the most charming and bright fashion and said, let me have a look at it. So I said, good, fine. And instead of doing anything, and I never really thought about it at the time, never gave it a second thought. Tell you what you do. You take care of it tonight, and I'll give you a couple of things so you can bathe it a bit, because it's very swollen. But you come down to me at 8:30 tomorrow morning, and I'll...